Welcome to the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. This audio tape is an educational that presents our vision of a new cooperative world and how to achieve it. The topics are, what is a revolutionary and what do they do? Our audio tapes are used for self-education, in study groups, and any other type of event where people come together to understand the world and how to change it. We suggest that you also study our program, convention documents, and our newspaper, The People's Tribune, along with this tape. This tape is a speech presented by Nelson Peary, founding member of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, and award-winning author of Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary, to a group in Madison, Wisconsin. We welcome any suggestions you may have for further educationals. For more information on the League, our newspapers, speakers, and radio programs, please call 1-800-691-6888.
I was asked to discuss with you the question of what is a revolutionary? Because today, I think it's clear that what we're seeing emerging is all kinds of people who call themselves revolutionaries because they're opposed to the system. And that's a very good thing. We want them to continue that opposition. But we want to take a look and see what is a revolutionary today and what do they do. I think perhaps the first thing we should do is to look at what is a revolution. Because a revolution is basically motion. I would like to just point out that the whole world is in motion, right? Everything is arising and changing and dying away and being reborn. That motion is the whole essence of life. So one of the biggest questions I imagine that faces the philosophers and the revolutionaries is to try to understand why is it that things do change. Things change when their environments change. The environment that they live by, when it changes, then they have to change. If they don't change, they have to die. So the other thing I wanted to point out is that in every process is the environment for another process. So the whole world is interconnected. This motion, this complex interconnection and interconnection that we see throughout the world, this motion, we generally refer to it as evolution. Now, the problem with society is that once we created a society with classes, with a ruling class and with subordinate classes, that ruling class come to the conclusion real quick, well, we don't want to change. So they've prevented society from evolving along with everything that society depended upon, right? So what we see then, that the process was, as far as society is concerned, was stopped. Now, the economic environment that society lives in is an objective, real thing. Nobody can change that, and no ruling class can change the economy and the evolution of the economy that we live in. And as this contradiction between a static society on the one hand and a constantly evolving economic environment for that society, as it continues to develop, we begin to have social antagonisms. And finally, we get to the point where this antagonism creates a crisis, society breaks the restraints that the ruling class imposes upon it, and society takes a great leap forward and aligns itself accurately with the economic environment within which it lives. So we see that when we talk about revolution, we're really talking about, essentially, we're talking about evolution that takes place with leaps. And so I think if we agree that the processes, the revolutionary process, is something kind of alien in the real world, but at the same time, it is what happens in society, and that if we're going to understand revolutionaries, the first thing we have to do then, understand revolution. And understanding revolution, it seems to me, the first point is to understand society, because that's what you revolt within, right? I went to the dictionary again. Every now and then I'm forced to go back there. I think I know all these words, but I go back and I find out that there's a whole new different meaning in the dictionary. So I looked up society before I came here and wrote it down. And the Webster Dictionary states that society is, quote, a highly structured system of human organization for large-scale community living. Well, I think that's a very fine definition, but I think it left out the essential point. And I think that essential point is that society is organized around the way that it produces and distributes the means of existence. I mean, that's what the fundamentals of society really is. Some people got to produce one thing, other people produce another thing, and then how do you distribute? Since you have a division of labor, how do you distribute in order to allow for people to exist? History shows us that there can't be a society unless there's a division of labor. Everybody can't do the same thing. So if you divide the labor process, then you have to exchange in order to come up with a finished product, in order to come up with something that you can live with. It seems to me clear then that this division of labor rests upon and is a reflection of what kind of tools that society uses. An agrarian society is going to have one division of labor. A hunting and gathering society is going to have a different division of labor. And an industrial society certainly is going to have a different division of labor. So what happens then when new means of production are introduced into an old division of labor? For example, we know what happened when the steam engine was introduced into the division of labor that we call agriculture. It wrecked the agricultural society almost overnight. If you consider that from the invention of the double-acting steam engine, which was about 1831, I believe, from 1831 to 1865, that's 30 years, right? Revolution swept the entire earth. The Chinese Revolution, a revolution in Japan, revolution in France, revolution in England, revolution everywhere on the face of the earth. And, of course, the Civil War in the United States, which was our revolutionary process. And so we see that with every single introduction of a new way of producing wealth, that society becomes wrecked and has to reform itself around the new way of producing wealth. The response that people have to these changes is very different from the changes themselves, right? So the task of the revolutionary in history, it seems to me, is to alert the masses to the economic changes that are taking place and to give them a vision of what kind of a world can be created based on these new means of production. First of all, I think all of you know, our society is under attack. That it's being attacked from every conceivable angle, morally, economically, politically, socially, from every aspect. Listen to the politicians and their war on drugs and their war on crime and their war on teenage pregnancy and their war on the instability of the family and all the rest of it, just to name a few. Well, you would think, and of course they want you to think, that it's these questions that are wrecking society, rather than taking an objective view and seeing that the rise of crime, of drugs, of poverty, of homelessness is an expression of society in destruction. It is not the cause of it. And if we could get this part over, I think then we'd be able to look and more rationally at how do we go from here to struggle with this thing. Well, if something changes in a process, it seems to me we have to look for change in the foundation or the fundamentals of that process, and not just look at the process itself, but look underneath what is the underlying factors that determine whether that process is stable or unstable. And to do this, I would like to just look for a minute at what's happened in America over the last, 20 or 25 years. I live in Chicago. And this process I want to talk about is especially evident in an industrial town such as Chicago. If you look at the neighborhoods, the industrial neighborhoods in Chicago, say in 1970, you saw fairly prosperous, stable neighborhoods. Families were stable, the kids were clean, and, weren't hanging out in gangs, they were going to school, they were looking forward to a future of some kind or another, going to college and so forth. The old man was working, probably mom was working, in the factory that is within that neighborhood. And since they were making money, they were buying homes, and they were paying taxes, and the factory was producing, and it was paying taxes, and the result of it was the streets were cleaned, the garbage was picked up, the schools were of a fairly decent caliber, and life was relatively stable and pretty good way to live. But then what happened? The scientists began the process of applying the principles of the computer to industrial production. That is to say that they would watch the motions of the worker as they produced, and then replicate this on with a computer so the computer could guide a robot to do exactly what that worker did, but without any wages. So what happened to the factory? And not only did the computer allow for automation, the computer led to a control of production that we've never known before. That is to say that you can have a factory in Brazil today and have the same control over it from Madison as if that factory were right across the street. So this control allowed them to immediately move their factory to Mexico, to Brazil, to Indonesia, to wherever, to get away from the high wages and get away from the unions. And so what happens then when the factory either automates or moves to a low-wage area? Stop paying taxes. And the workers don't have jobs. So what happens to the neighborhood? Well, if you don't pay taxes, you aren't going to get your garbage picked up. And your alley isn't going to be clean, and you're going to have some mean killer cops instead of people there that are supposed to serve you. And right down the line, we see this decline that began taking place with the introduction of automation in the factories. If we take a look at the whole process, I think we have to come to the conclusion that an economic revolution inevitably begins the process of social revolution. First of all, what is economic revolution? And why does it spell the end of a system? Well, what is the capitalist system? Capitalist system is the buying and selling of labor. That's the whole basis of it, or I should say labor power, that the whole idea of capitalism is that the worker has one thing to sell, and that's his ability to work. He sells that to the capitalist. The capitalist uses that in the process of manufacturing commodities, sells it back, or at least sells some of it back, to the people who produced it. And this circuit of the buying and selling of, or the selling of labor power on one hand, and buying the commodities, and on the other hand, the buying of labor power and the selling of commodities. And this circuit, so long as it's connected, it worked very unevenly and wasn't a very good system, but it worked. So what happens when you introduce robotics and automation into a system based upon the sale of labor power? Well, the robot doesn't ask for any labor, any wages. Doesn't ask for any vacations, doesn't ask for anything. Maybe a shot of grease here and there, but doesn't ask for anything of any consequences. So how are you going to price the commodities that are constructed or built by a robot? Can't. And the whole destabilization of the currencies of the world is based exactly on that point. Before you could say that, well, I don't know how much this microphone is worth, but let's say that it's worth, it took 2 hours to produce it, well, that microphone could be exchanged for anything else that took 2 hours to produce. But how are you going to do this with a robot? And furthermore, how are you going to exchange when people have less and less and less money? So we see that the process of first is economic revolution, the changing of the economy, which affects the society that rests upon it, and the first stage of the social revolution is the destruction of the existing society. Now, so far, this whole process has been objective. Nobody could stop it. You can't stop the factory from putting a robot in there. You can't stop the destruction of the neighborhoods. You can't stop the rise of this police state that's developing as a result of the decline of the standards of living of the American people. That's all part of an objective process in history. But there's the other side of this is, though, is how do human beings respond to this tremendous change that they see taking place in front of them? Well, first of all, they begin forming organizations to combat specific things, right? They don't see the entire social process, the whole process. What they see is the growth of homelessness. And so organizations are formed to combat homelessness. And then somebody else forms an organization to combat the decline of the educational standards. And somebody else begins fighting to stabilize the healthcare system. Nobody is struggling along the whole system, only seeing the bits and pieces of the destruction of society that's taking place in front of them. This period of time, books are written condemning this situation, that so far, everybody has been dealing with results, and nobody has been dealing with causes. So as this social process develops towards crisis and becomes antagonistic, Politically advanced people begin to question the system itself. And we've already entered, I believe, that stage. And the first people who begin to question the system isn't the worker, or isn't the, you know, the people who are hurt the worst. They might grumble about it, but they don't have any, they don't really challenge it. Who challenges it are the intellectuals in service of the ruling class. People such as Jerry Rifkin, for example, who's head of the big think tank there in Washington, D.C. And he wrote this really excellent book, The End of Work, in which he was warning the ruling class, hey, what are you going to do here? You know, you're creating a society that out of 126 million jobs that are available or that are in existence today, some 96 million of them are going to be automated or done by robots by the year 2010. So what the heck are you going to do with 96 million workers laid off and their families thrown into poverty? So he writes this book not for the worker, not to arouse the working class, but to try to tell the ruling class, hey, you guys had better do something. You had better find some way to resolve this kind of a contradiction. Well, there isn't any way to solve the contradiction. And because there isn't any way to solve it, spontaneous groups slowly begin to arise against the system. If you ask them what the system was, they couldn't tell you, right? And what they're going to do, what they're going to replace it with, they couldn't tell you that either. But they do know that something is terribly wrong and it's systemic. It's not something wrong with the president or something wrong with Congress or something wrong with the governor. It's an entire system that's bad. And I think we're beginning to get into that process today, where organizations and individuals are coming forth that are opposed to the system as a whole. They began then to sense that the second stage of social revolution is at hand. Not beginning yet, but it's coming up on the agenda. And that second stage is that after social destruction, then the question is social reconstruction or social reorganization. And then the question becomes, who is going to reorganize American society in whose interests? At this point, the revolutionary begins to come forth. Then what is a revolutionary? Above everything else, revolutionaries are visionaries. Now, when I say vision, I don't mean dreams. I have a dream, to be sure. Every Friday evening, I walk to the corner drugstore and I lay down my dollar on the lottery. And I have a dream that I'm going to win the lottery. And I dream about my motor home and my house and all the rest that comes with $5 or $6 million. It's a stupid dream. It's not going to happen. It doesn't have any foundation, right? There's nothing concrete that that dream arises from. So when we talk about vision, we're talking about ideas that develop on the basis of new means of production. If we look at the history of the United States, America has produced some marvelous visionaries. In the Revolutionary War, and especially in the Civil War, that we produced the most marvelous visionaries that the world has ever known, I believe. The preamble of the Constitution of the United States has been followed by every single country that has liberated itself since 1776, has used some aspect of that preamble to our Constitution. Because it was created by visionaries, people who believed that once they got rid of the king, got rid of that feudal system, then they could talk in terms of building an entirely new world based upon liberty and so forth. Abe Lincoln was a visionary. If you read the Gettysburg Address, one of the things that struck me when I got to be about 70 years old and reread it, and I said, man, this guy is rewriting the entire social process of the United States, rewriting our Constitution, because he knew darn good and well that the United States wasn't conceived in liberty. He wasn't talking about 1776. He was talking about 1865. He created a whole new concept of an America. And a person like Walt Whitman grabbed that right away. In this beautiful poem of his, Ode to Democracy, when he says, come with me, we will build the most beautiful race the sun has ever shone upon. And he thought in terms of an amalgamation of the Indian and the African and the European into a whole new race that they call Americans. Walt Whitman was a great visionary. I knew a visionary of that period. I guess I'm squealing on how old I am. But my great-grandfather, who I knew very well, I mean, he died when I was about 10, so I remember him very well. He was 35 years a slave and fought in the Civil War. And he used to tell me and tell all of us about this kind of vision that he had, because back then when we didn't have radios or we didn't have television, the people talked to one another, and especially the older people talked to the youngsters. And he used to tell me, or me, well, I have six brothers, he would tell us about, as a slave, when the war started, and he thought in terms that if he could get a hold of this land that he toiled on as a slave, if he could gain ownership of that land, then he could feed his family, he could see they were educated and housed, he could take care of not only his children, but his grandchildren as well. He had this vision, so he ran away and went to war, became a soldier and decorated soldier in the Civil War, and at the end of the war, really tried to implement that vision. It was not possible because the land doesn't produce enough to create an abundance that will allow for that vision to come true. Every time there's a change in the means of production, and every time there's a process of social disorganization, destruction, and social reconstruction, visionaries come forth and begin examining, now what is possible with that steam engine? What is possible with this computer, with automation? And I think this is the thing that we face today. I think that the thing we want to look to most of all, what is the revolutionary vision of today? That it certainly can't be the same vision that came forth from the steam engine or from the development of the plow or any of these things. That is something qualitatively new that we're dealing with today. And I think, first of all, we have to look at what we have in order to project into the future. I became a revolutionary, I think, maybe in 1938 or 39 when I was in my late teens. And I became a revolutionary because it finally occurred to me that the racial oppression, and in 1938 and 39, that period, it was horrendous. When you're talking about the beatings and lynchings and burning at the stake and the killing of women and children, it was a horrendous, fascist, horrible thing that was going on in America. And every black kid grew up saying, the white folks, the white folks, the white folks. And finally it occurred to me that it was the manipulation of scarcity. When the ruling class has control of the necessaries of life, and there are not enough of them to go around for everybody, then they can bring over various groupings and, you know, with privileges. Then until we have a society of abundance, there is no way to stop the terrible things that arise on the basis of scarcity. The oppression of women, for example. What's it there for? Because of the male ego? Not at all. It's an economic thing. The oppression of the nationalities. I don't care what aspect of the inequalities that you look at in the modern world, these social evils arise from the manipulation of scarcity and the manipulation of privileges based upon that scarcity. We look at the globalization and automation put together, we see one thing that can be argued. We are living in a world of superabundance. There is enough and more than enough for every human being on the face of the earth, and we're just barely entering into this period of electronics. All the social evils that are the result of scarcity, all of these can be overcome on the basis of the allotment of this tremendous superabundance. And it seems to me that this vision is that finally humanity's dream of ending stultifying labor, the most awful, well, maybe the second most awful word in the dictionary, we're talking about the war, maybe war is a worse word, but certainly the second most worst word is work. I mean, there is no way for a human being to develop working 8, 10, 12 hours a day in some kind of stultifying, degrading, crushing labor, to come home absolutely exhausted, yell at the kids, fight with his wife, fall out and go to sleep and try to get ready to go to work the next day, that is not any way to go about creating a cultured human being. That human being has to first free themselves from this stultifying labor. The robot does this. That we can say that with an end of work and with an end of exploitation, that humanity can finally begin this journey into intellectual and cultural development that we've talked about over so many years. The revolutionary vision is for an orderly, and when I say orderly, I don't mean somebody ordering you around. I mean to be able to get up in the morning and know darn good and well that I'm going to have food, know that I have medical care, know that my kids are going to go to school, know that the cop's not going to shoot me, know that nobody's going to rob me. This is what I mean by an orderly world. A world at peace. Because if there's abundance, and there is abundance, there is no need for war. There's no need for the kind of struggles that we've seen in the past. A democratic society. Because, you know, I heard the word democracy when I wasn't allowed to go to school. I had to go work. And the white kids went to school. And they talked, we learned, when I was in the fields, we learned about democracy. And finally it occurred to me, by the time I was a teenager, it occurred to me that the only way you can have democracy if you control your means of existence. If somebody else controls your means of existence, you are their slave. And I don't have any way of feeding myself. I don't own any land, I don't own any farm, I don't have any way of feeding myself. If I could feed myself, I couldn't farm because I don't know how to make iron for a plow, and I don't have a horse, I don't have a tractor. I mean, this world is so complex that there is no way for one human being to establish democracy. It has to be for everybody, or else it can't be for anybody. And the world we live in has found a way to evade, that's for sure. You visualize this peaceful, orderly, democratic world based upon a superabundance of everything that's needed for a happy and peaceful existence. All that's at hand. What's the problem? The problem is that the people who control these marvelous means of production, they have no intention of allowing you to get your hands on that and manipulate these means of production in the interests of the masses of the people of the earth. So therefore, the visionary must become a revolutionary, just as much as a revolutionary must be a visionary. Now, to accomplish this, it seems to me, the revolutionary has got to become a propagandist. Anybody can sit up and say, well, you know, I believe this and I believe that and I believe the other. But one thing about it, I don't care, I guess most Reds are frustrated preachers in a sense of the word, because they got to get out and preach. There's no way to tell me you have a vision and you're going to keep it to yourself. If you really have a vision, you're out there. You're on the street corners, you're publishing a paper, you're passing out leaflets, you got getting on the radio, you're writing a book, you're doing anything that's possible to get that vision placed before the rest of the people so it can grab them the way that it's grabbed you, that you don't have to live like this. There's no excuse for homelessness. Not one child need to be deprived. We can live a happy life, but you must place these means of production at the disposal of society. You have to take them away from the capitalists. And if they resist, you got to just do it. It's clear, I think, that we're at that point where we have to begin this process. That when we look at the world today, if you don't believe the system is collapsing, just because it's not collapsing in Madison, that there's 6 billion people in the world today. 3.5 billion of them today are in poverty. That wasn't true 3 years ago, 5 years ago. When I was hoboing, the first thing you'd ask yourself, which direction is this train going in? Where is it going? I mean, how fast the train was going was the secondary question. Where is the train going? Which direction is it going in? And the same thing we have to ask today, which direction is the world going in today? Greater and greater poverty. Greater and greater oppression, greater and greater crushing of the mass of human life around the entire planet. 6 billion people, 3.5 in poverty, 1.5 in absolute destitution. I was looking at a TV program a couple of days ago. This marvelous man in Latin America who was trying to defend the children. Can you imagine in Costa Rica where police gouge out the eyes of these homeless children so that they won't bother the tourists? I mean, that's the kind of horror that's going on in the world today. The world is economically collapsing, and the threat of depression is creeping forward everywhere. And we are in a very, very serious situation. Now, we have all the wherewithal to solve this problem. But as one great philosopher once said, that the only revolutionary thing on the face of the earth is the human mind. That if we don't win the human mind over, if we don't win the hearts and minds of the American people to grasping this vision that I spoke of, then all the depression and oppression and destruction in the world is not going to liberate anything. That this is the time of propagandists, a time of revolutionaries to step forth. And I might say just in closing that those of you who have or tonight might grasp that vision of a world based on electronics, on the computers, a world without back-breaking labor, a world without violence, a world dedicated to peace. If you can grasp that vision, welcome to the revolution then. Water's fine. Come on in. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here.
Welcome to the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. This audio tape is an educational that presents our vision of a new cooperative world and how to achieve it. The topics are, what is a revolutionary and what do they do? Our audio tapes are used for self-education, in study groups, and any other type of event where people come together to understand the world and how to change it. We suggest that you also study our program, convention documents, and our newspaper, The People's Tribune, along with this tape. This tape is a speech presented by Nelson Peary, founding member of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America and award-winning author of Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary, to a group in Madison, Wisconsin. We welcome any suggestions you may have for further educationals. For more information on the League, our newspapers, speakers, and radio programs, please call 1-800-691-6888. Hey.